anybody who wants to review things can. I thought I would say a little bit about what we've been doing up to this point for the last week or two, and then see if we could start a discussion on what you thought interesting about this, I think, crazy and fascinating legal system associated with a civilization that we're supposed to view with great respect. And then if we run out of discussion, I've got my own sort of summaries of some of the stuff there. You're not reading anything like all of the book, but I do have up on the webpage links to the syllabus my outline of the whole book, which I think will give you at least a rough idea of the stuff that you aren't reading. And if you have the time, I think it's quite an interesting book, and you may want to read more of it than you're required to. So the subject we were really on last time, and to some extent for the time before that, is the issue of how you enforce contracts when you don't have a system of state courts that are doing it. And it's a context that I would argue arises in all sorts of different places. It arises in China, in Imperial China, where you have a legal system and a court system, but they aren't very interested in enforcing contracts. It arises in a stateless society, such as the Roman Chal gypsies that we discussed. It's in the process of arising in cyberspace, where a lot of disputes are in practice not going to make it into the courts for various practical reasons. And it obviously exists in criminal markets and in political markets, where people are making contracts that courts won't enforce for one reason or another, but where contracts are still important. And we'll get back to some of this probably at later points in the course, because it's one of the, to me, sort of interesting issues that runs through looking at different societies, sort of the tension between the way we get rules enforced that we're used to thinking of and that law school is largely about, by suing people and charging them with crimes and such, and the other mechanisms which I think in all societies exist in various ways to get people to behave. In the case of contracts, we discussed simultaneous performance as sort of the easiest way of doing it. You give me something at the same time I give you something. Synchronizing your performance in such a way that at each point as the contract plays out, neither party can get much gain by backing out, because I've paid you part of the money and you've built part of the house. The use of hostages of various sorts, literal or metaphorical hostages, and reputation is an obvious mechanism by which we enforce things. Any questions on that stuff before we go on to ancient Athens? No. All right. We're always told that Athens was a democracy, that they invented democracy as well as inventing jury trials. In what sense was Athens a democracy? How did the political system work? Can anybody sort of give me a very, very brief summary of, you know, how do you become a magistrate in Periclean Athens, in this great democracy? Anyone want to tell me? The magistrates are sort of the government officials of various sorts, and there are lots and lots of them responsible for different things. So how do you get to be a magistrate? Anyone? Have an election, campaign for office. It's a democracy.
Was it by lot among the aristocratic families?
It was by lot, but it was not among the aristocratic families. There was no aristocracy in any formal sense. It was by lot among the adult male citizens. Are you talking about before? I'm talking about roughly the period that the book is concerned with.
Okay.
Which is there.
The introduction
is the introduction is trying to tease out from very limited evidence what the earlier system was. But by the time we're talking about the Athenian democracy, which is after the reforms of Solon, by that point, all offices with one exception, namely generals, strategoi, all other offices were filled by lot. And anybody notice what the term of service was? How long do you get to be a magistrate for? Anybody? Stuff's discussed in some detail in the stuff you've read for today. If you haven't read it, you are cheating yourself. A year, correct. That's right. It's a one-year term. And how do we make sure that this amateur magistrate does his job? What to keep him from taking bribes and using his position as a magistrate to impose, magistrates can impose small fines without going through the courts. What's to keep him from finding everybody he doesn't like and taking bribes not to do things with regard to people he likes and so forth. Anybody? What constraints are there?
Can they bring suit against
in particular, at the end of every magistrate's term of office, there's more or less an automatic review in which he can be charged with malfeasance in office. That's right. Yeah. Correct. And so, in effect, I mean, part of what the more you read about it, the stranger it seems, this is entirely a government of amateurs. All right, it's just sort of the obvious. You think about our system, where not only do congressmen have to get elected, but in practice, it's practically life tenure. That almost no incumbent ever loses an election in our system, but very occasionally it happens. And so these are people whose career, whose life has been spent being politicians, and ditto for the non-elected offices, the Secretary of the Treasury or whatever, the different government officials. They're basically all professionals. They may be professionals with sort of a range of activities. The Secretary of the Treasury might have been a professor of economics or president of Harvard or something before that, but he's somebody who in some sense is trained for the job. This is a system where the random dog catcher might end up as a Secretary of the Treasury. If there had been a Secretary of the Treasury, might end up as the magistrate in charge or something or other. And yet, by some tenors, it was a strikingly successful society. It's sort of one of the most famous societies in history. It provided great literature. It created an alliance, then compelled all its allies to become subjects and created an empire, the Athenian Empire, fought against the Persian Empire successfully, fought against the Spartans and their allies, and eventually lost after a very long war. But, this was not a failure on historical ground. If you sort of think of what gets accomplished by different societies, it has high points and low points, this crazy, impossible system nonetheless appears to have been a functional society for 100-some years, doing all sorts of stuff. What were some of the potentials for gaming the system? I think one of the things that one would always like to ask, especially if you imagine the modern context where Obama has a proposal for health care reform, or somebody else has a proposal for tort reform, or it doesn't matter which side of, whether it's Republicans or Democrats or whatever, but anytime someone proposes a substantial change in the way something's organized, one of the questions you should ask is, under this new set of rules, how do you cheat? Under this new set of rules, how do you game it? There's a wonderful sort of spoof essay by an economist called George Stigler, in which purports to be the story of how some ambitious young intellectual, his father or something, leads a successful coup somewhere in South America. He's from South America, the character, and he gets put in charge of the universities. And the basic point of the essay is to say, if you were a sort of intelligent person looking at the university system, how would you reform it? And the guy gets some obviously sensible idea for reforming it, and he does that reform, and all sorts of terrible things happen. He's going to solve the problem. He reforms this in another way, and a different set of terrible things happen. And in each case, he's setting up what sounds like a sensible arrangement without thinking about how people will game it. So that, for example, he's trying to set up objective standards for hiring professors and giving them tenure. And, how do you do it? You have some number of points for an article, some number of points for a book. Somebody looks at that system and says, I was about to publish this book, but if I broke up its chapters into 14 articles, I'd get 14 points for the articles instead of 4 points for the book. And he sets up his examination system to have examiners from some leading American university. So what happens? The graduate students all run off to the American university to study under the right examiner and then come back and win their professorship positions. I don't remember all the details, but it's just sort of a neat idea of trying to sort of say what can go wrong with whatever your great, great scheme is. So if you think about sort of our standard liberal democracy, the obvious reason it couldn't possibly work, although so far it hasn't happened, is that obviously the majority will vote to tax all of the rich people and live in comfort themselves. Obviously, whoever wins one election will then arrange to take over the FBI, have all the strong candidates of the other party accused of. You can think of all sorts of ways it could go wrong, some of these systems do go wrong. I mean, depending on the particular society you're thinking of. Early in our history, the President of the United States charged the person who I think had just been Vice President, and this was back in a system where the President and the Vice President didn't run together. right, where the vice president was the guy who came in second for president, basically. And they charged the vice president with all sorts of treason. Did not succeed in convicting him, as it happened. This is Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, if I remember correctly, are the two characters. So there are lots of ways in which systems can go wrong. There's a famous line, I'm not sure it was ever spoken, with regard to a certain pre-Civil War law case, the Chief Justice has made the law, now let him enforce it. And I think that's supposed to be associated with the events just before the Trail of Tears, when a very large number of people died as a result of the president deciding to deport a whole bunch of people from one part of the U.S. to another because they happened to be Indians instead of Americans, ordinary Americans. Anyway, my point is only that any of these systems worth thinking about. So you're in Athens at this time, and you want to get somebody. What do you do? Your political opponent. Yeah?
Oh, political opponent.
For example. Or just somebody you don't like the guy who married the woman you wanted to marry. What are some of the things you could try doing? Yeah, you get somebody to prosecute him for some offense. You make sure that the prosecutor is a really good orator. Hopefully the guy is somebody who doesn't have a very good public presence, is not, you know, ultimately likable. If you look at American presidents, I think it's perfectly clear that Nixon's fatal flaw was that he was a lousy demagogue. That we've had good demagogues on both sides. Reagan was a first-rate demagogue. Clinton was an almost as good demagogue. And that has to do with, can you give a speech and make people love you, make people be impressed. Nixon was just terrible. If Nixon was telling the truth, you'd think he was lying, let alone when he was lying. So if you're lucky, your opponent is that kind of a guy, and your prosecutor is some, you know, wonderfully, you know, homey, somebody like Clinton or Reagan, basically, would do just fine. I'm sure there are modern people in the legal system as well who would do that. So you accuse the guy of something terrible. You get him convicted with a whopping big fine. Your prosecutor gets half the fine, and maybe you give him a little extra because you appreciate having hurt your enemy and so forth. All right? So you don't have to worry about things of this sort in any such system. But to some extent, they do. What's the other obvious way of winning a law? Yep. Well, except that anybody can prosecute you.
You talked about if someone was going to bring charges, they would bribe.
To drop the charges, yeah. Notice, though, that in this system's very, very loosely analogous to our criminal civil distinction, there's a distinction between cases that anybody, any adult male Athenian citizen can bring and cases that only a particular person can bring. So in the latter case, you could do it. One of the things that he never discusses, and we may not know, is whether there's any double jeopardy rule. So suppose I charge you with a specific offense, and you're acquitted. Can he then charge you with the same offense? I don't know. I don't even know if we know. Yeah?
In the last section, in the punishment section, or maybe in the acquittal section, it seemed, I was looking at a double jeopardy rule. It seemed like he could be tried again if there was an insufficiency in the first hearing.
What does an insufficiency mean?
Like if there was testimony given that turned out to be false,
uh-huh,
or something like that.
So if you had grounds for reopening the case, as it were, you could. You know, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. So, but in any case, it's clear that one of the it's pretty clear. He thinks, and I've raised the same issue in other systems, that one of the things that happens is you prosecute someone, preferably somebody rich, and you then say, I'll drop the case if you'll pay me off. Is that legal? Not in that system, correct. It's also illegal in the system that I originally was thinking about the idea in, which is 18th century English criminal law. It was legal, however, for 18th century cases short of felony. Legal and approved of, to have set out of court settlements. And of course, it's legal in our system. In our criminal law, it's perfectly legal to do it. It's just that your payment has to consist of testimony that the prosecutor wants against somebody else. Right? There's nothing illegal, as far as I can tell, or if it's illegal, it's a non-enforced law, about the prosecutor saying to the minor defendant, we'll let you off at the last slap on the wrist, or maybe even we'll drop charges, if you'll give us the testimony that we want against this guy we're really trying to get. Well, that's an out-of-court settlement. It's not for cash. We have some for cash as well. If, I mean, in not in, well, in is there a context in which you get a settlement in which somebody agrees to contribute money to something or other, where there's a public prosecutor as well as obviously out-of-court settlements. In a tort case, it's perfectly legitimate. And presumably, that's one of the things people worry about with regard to tort reform, is that you sue a rich company on some implausible grounds, and then you say to the company, look, if we can sell this crazy idea to the jury, you're out $100 million. How about paying us $2 million to settle? And your client will pretend it's $10 million because you'll give us $2 million, the lawyers, and $8 million will give in the form of discounts to future clients, future customers, which we will claim as part of your damage settlement with the class that I the lawyer, am representing. So this is an issue you've got to worry about in all systems, but there's certainly one there. How do we know about the law? What kind of sources do we have? That's for any historical question, that's something you really want to ask, because it tells you a lot about how much you really know and how sure you can be. Yeah?
There were citations that brought this as history as well as actual arguments and speeches.
Yes, there's one of the major sources is actual surviving speeches. So the speeches, I presume, were preserved as literature because they were great oratory, but they were speeches that were typically... The defense can't have somebody speak for him. But he can have somebody compose a speech which he then memorizes. And I guess the prosecutor speaks for himself, but the prosecutor decided to be a prosecutor, so he may be a good orator himself. If you want a sort of a vivid and perhaps accurate picture, I'm not sure, Mary Renault, no longer alive, was a very prominent historical novelist in the 20th century. Most of her books, almost all of her books are set in Greece. Or at least Greek culture. There's a 3-volume set on Alexander the Great, part of which is in Greece, most of which isn't. But there's a bunch of them that are set basically in Athens in this period. She clearly knew the society very well. I think that was sort of the general public opinion of it. And they're very believable. And they sort of bring, flesh out, as it were, this stuff with what that society seems to have, at least a plausible guess about what that society was really like. So one of the sources is, I think at the beginning, I have forgotten, but it was one of the major sources, and I think it might have been something associated with Aristotle, maybe that he wrote or that he was pseudo-Aristotle, maybe. Yes, I know. I'm just trying to see, because I remember that I am reasonably certain that he did say, I remember that question occurred to me as well, and I'm trying to figure out where. Did anybody else notice? I have a vague feeling. Yeah. Just a minute. Yes, no, that's a good question. What? Yeah, that's a modern source, but I think that AP is actually a. Yeah, so it's a pseudo Aristotle. Yeah, so where did you find that? Very good, very good. So that's the answer to your question, which I shall refer to as AP. So that's Athenian Politeia, which purports to be written by Aristotle, but we don't actually know if it was written by Aristotle. A lot of stuff that got attributed to Aristotle, we either know wasn't written by him or think was, because he was a famous enough figure so that he was the person, the name to put on the thing you'd actually written, or you didn't know who the author was, but you wanted to impress people. So again, I don't know how much time your studies lead you for life literature, but these are good books, and historical fiction is dangerous because if it's badly done, you're getting a picture that's completely wrong. But I think Renault pretty clearly knew what she was talking about. You have the feeling in some of her stuff that she really identified more with being a citizen of classical Greece than with being a modern British and later South African citizen. She's got one of the books, which I have one of my favorites, The Praise Singer, which is really about tyranny. Except the tyranny to the ancient Greeks wasn't a negative term. What a tyrant was a popular dictator. And you might like him, you might dislike him, and it's pretty clear that Renault's view is that tyranny is the best form of government, provided you've got the right tyrant. So that she has in this book three different portraits of three different tyrannies. And the first one, I think that you see, the tyrant is corrupt but competent. He's the ruler of an island in the Aegean somewhere. And he makes his rake off and lives in luxury, but he's got to keep his island prosperous to do that, and the result is that when he's finally killed, it's a catastrophe. The second one, the tyrant is old, competent, and virtuous. And in fact, as Renault tells the story, the tyrant was the younger lover of Solon, the man who gave the Athenians their laws. And when he's talking to the protagonist at one point as an old man, when he's in fact the ruler of Athens, he says, you know, Solon gave them the laws, and then everybody approved of everything except one thing. Everybody wanted the laws changed in some way to favor him. And so Solon left Athens, saying that he wasn't there, they couldn't make him change the law. They kept his law. They keep it still, I see to that, who could have given them laws they would have liked less well. And so you can see how sort of the memory of his dead lover is what's kept him honest in some sense. And it's really quite a moving book. It's called The Praise Singer, and the protagonist is a professional poet. And he's a professional poet, only, about four lines of whose have survived. And those lines are, "Stranger, if you come to Sparta, tell that here, obedient to the law, we fell." That's the epitaph for the soldiers who died at Thermopylae. And so she's created a character around that. Somebody, all we know about him is that he wrote that, but she made him into an interesting character. Anyway, and then you later see what happens when the virtuous tyrant dies and his sons take over, and for a little while they do a good job sort of running on momentum, and then the thing's system slides down until they're assassinated. Which is historical, by the way. Which is like good historical novel. It's a mix of what we know is true and what she imagines to fit in the stories. Anyway, so I would recommend that. So, in addition to the oration, we do have some. We have that book that was being described, where there's some dispute as to how reliable it is. We have the texts of some laws. There were laws that were inscribed on stone, and we've got at least parts of the stones left. In addition, they apparently would, as a way of showing that there were legal constraints on land, they would have a stone in the field, which basically says, you know, this land is mortgaged for 1,000 drachma to so-and-so, in order that if I tried to sell you the land, you would see the stone and realize it was encumbered. And some of those have survived as well. So we've got very, and also, of course, he quotes at various points from the literature, from the comedies, where you can see a perhaps tongue-in-cheek portrayal. In a sense, none of this is really reliable. That you know, an inscribed law is a short description. We don't really know how it got filled out in practice. The orations, they may have been lying. If you're trying to win a law case, you may misrepresent what the law is. You will surely selectively represent the parts that support your case and not the parts that undermine your case and so forth. But put all of these things together, and I think you can get a moderately good picture. And part of what's really striking about that system is that it is got a government, it's got a legal system, it's got courts, it's got legislature, but what it doesn't have is hierarchy, at least above the level of citizen. That it's got a sharp division between citizens, medics, and slaves. Those are the three categories. It's got very sharp differences between the legal rights of men and women. Probably, I think, even sharper than most traditional societies. I hope you realize that our society is extraordinary in how little distinction we make on those grounds. But there is no king. There's nothing like a king. The Renault book I was describing is set before this period. And so there had been a point at which there were aristocrats, and in a somewhat official sense, there had been a point at which there were people who were de facto rulers. The person she's describing isn't the king. He's just the guy who's, everybody knows, who better do what he says or else. So in a certain sense, if you start, as it were, at the citizen class, it was a relatively egalitarian society. One man, one vote for those things. What did they vote on? They didn't vote to elect officials. What did they vote on? What did the whole electorate vote on? The jury got to vote on a particular case, but what did the whole electorate vote on? Mainly. Any Suppose that you're, again, you're an ambitious bad guy who's a good orator and has got lots of friends, and instead of charging your enemy with a crime, what else might you do? How about passing a law against him? Find something he's doing that's important to him that's entirely legal and pass a law making it illegal. All right. You know, there's been a lot of talk recently over the fact that various bankers and such get large bonuses. And so what's one of the proposals? That the federal government should make a law limiting those bonuses in ways of things of that sort of limiting the pay of CEOs. Well, in Athens, you don't have to persuade Congress. You've got to persuade those Athenian citizens who show up in the assembly. Because the assembly is the lawmaking body. There are some additional complications at various times. I didn't think it was worth trying to go through all of the sort of details which the book provides. And there were times when, after you make the law, or before you make the law, you will submit it to some smaller body to say, does this contradict existing law? Is this clear enough? And so forth. But basically, the law is made by the assembly. And the assembly is simply everybody who shows up who's an adult male Athenian citizen. What do the officials do? It's suggested that early on magistrates may have in fact decided cases and then prosecuted cases, but that eventually by the time we're looking at the role of the magistrate in most legal contexts was just to be the official who sort of made it official. So that you, the prosecutor, go to the right magistrate and you say to the magistrate, I am commencing such and such a kind of a case against such and such a kind of a person, have him arrested and put in jail till the trial. Or, I have notified him that he is to show up at your court, you're presiding over that court, so that the magistrate is, in some sense, has a role in it, but it is not the role of initiator of courses, of cases, and for the most part it's not the role of judge in the deciding sense, though it might be judge in the sense of the person who is presiding over the procedure where a jury ends up deciding. How big are the juries?
500 to a couple thousand.
Yeah, that is, it's, we aren't sure in detail, but we know that there were special cases where they had large juries and they mentioned numbers like 1,500, and it looks as though the standard jury was probably 500 or 600, though there's some suggestion that at one point it might have been 700, but it's that kind of scale. It's a big jury. It's not quite what we think of as a jury. Sort of odd, the Icelandic case, you have what they call judges who look a lot more like our jury, and here you've got their jury, which I guess is a jury, but it, yep. That's a good question, and the answer is that I do not remember. It was certainly many thousands, and I doubt it was as much as a million citizens. I do, at some point I remember estimating that, and it may be if you check, I think I've got a link on the syllabus to various sort of wages and other number things, and I think, though I'm not positive, that somewhere in there you can look if one of you has got the, yeah? I think so. I think it was simple majority. I'm pretty sure that's right. Somebody's got a web connection. Don't I give an estimate of the population somewhere where I'm figuring things out there? Yeah. Well, if you find out, let us know, because I've forgotten. I think I did figure it out at some point or found it somewhere. Yeah. Yeah, one of the sort of things that's also an interesting project for any of these is to figure out how many numbers you can put to things. Because if somebody tells you the fine for being a sycophant, what's a sycophant, by the way? Right, somebody who engaged in abusive prosecution, basically. It's funny the way the word, I mean, several of the terms you'll notice as you read through it, you have words you know perfectly well what they mean, but it turns out they meant something entirely different back then. The fine is, I think, 1,000 drachma. Well, is that a lot or a little? Well, what sort of information do we have that you might tell you that?
Is it like jurors got paid too probably or something? Yes, I'm not sure what. That
yes.
In other words, it was oval, so it was 2 and then raised to 3, and there was also another unit used called the talent. And the talent was
big. That was big.
For a dowry, yeah, so it seemed like it was a big deal. Not, I just the idea that Opal would be bigger than Drachma because if there are more units of it, then it's probably a smaller thing. I don't know.
I don't think so. I think if I have to check, but my impression is that the juror's payment was around a drachma a day, because I think I've got some figures, and I think that it's something like that unskilled, that sort of ordinary workers are being paid by the state for state projects, I think 3 drachma a day, if I remember correctly. Again, if you check there, I worked out a bunch of those numbers, but that was some years ago, and I haven't memorized all of them. But it's useful if you say, well, what's this 1,000 drachma? A year's wages for an unskilled worker. And I don't know if that's exactly right, but that's the right order of magnitude. Just as when I was doing the Icelandic stuff, the question was, it sounds, you know, terrible that you can kill somebody and get off with a money payment. If that money payment is all the money you're going to make in your life, it's not such a light penalty. If it's, you know, if it's $50, it is. And so I made some attempts in that article to figure out ways in which you could get very rough estimates of what wages would have been in that society and what the value of a cow was and things like that, and try to use those to give you something close to a price index. Yeah, one. Yep. 800 citizens or total population?
It said increasing from a population of 800,000.
All right.
10 to 13 million, but it was talking about 800 BC or 400.
Ah. So. Yeah. So you have to see what it was then. Yeah. But in any case, it was certainly small by modern standards, but still enough people so that you could have 500 jurors and the city wouldn't shut down. But there are also some comments suggesting that people outside of Athens thought one of the funny things about Athens was they spent all their time being jurors instead of doing anything useful. I think he mentioned somewhere one of the comedies where someone from another city wants a uniquely Athenian product to take home as a souvenir, so they wrap up a juror and give it to him. As a uniquely Athenian, or at least especially Athenian product. The assembly, by the way, is called the Ecclesia, and I'm sure that has some connection with our terms ecclesiastic, but I do not know the relevant history of the word. And the basic sequence, as he conjectures it, is one in which initially the magistrates are really, maybe initially there's a king deciding things, but at least by historical times there are magistrates deciding things. The magistrates' decisions can get appealed to the assembly, so after a while they're all appealed, so the magistrates stop wasting their time trying to decide cases. All cases go to the assembly, but that's not workable, because if the assembly is all the adult male citizens, that means that everybody's spending 80 hours a day trying cases. So what's the great breakthrough they come up with in order to make it possible in some sense to have the whole citizen population decide every case? What is this great invention which echoes through history?
The jury.
The jury, right? So what they say is, we can't have all of us do it, so let's have just a selection of the population, a mere 500 people decide the case, and they represent the whole, as it were. And it's, you know, in one sense it's a myth, but it's a very popular myth. That, you know, if you think about arguments, if you don't like a law, and somebody says, you're bound by the law, and why are you bound by the law? Well, you're an American, and Americans decide on that law. Well, how do they do that? Well, there are 400 and some of them up in Washington called the House, and there are another 100 called the Senate. They decided on it. But that's us. All right, that's certainly a lot of the sort of the mythology of modern society, just as in the Athenian case, the mythology is those 500 are the citizens of Athens. I was just hearing, we just had a lunchtime talk about Islamic political systems, and the person there was arguing, in effect, that the reason you were bound by the law was that the caliph was, in some sense, the Islamic people, or the Islamic polity, as it were, and therefore you would consent to the law by he representing you had passed the law, kind of thing. So it's a fairly common idea. So in any case, they have the jury, and that takes care of that particular problem. Were the jurors chosen at random? They were volunteers, that's correct. So unlike our system, where you have to be a juror, in their case, it's the other way around. Yeah?
I was going to ask, like, volunteer system, is that another way to get manipulated?
That is, if it hadn't been paid, you would have wanted to worry that you might have a particular case which involves some issue that a few people cared about a lot, maybe all the ones who volunteered. in a sense, people argue that we have exactly the opposite problem, that the one of the complaints some people make about our jury system is that any juror who's really competent to have an opinion on the case is going to get eliminated by one side or the other, because if they know anything about you, then that lets either the prosecution or the defense predict that you'll vote the wrong way from their standpoint, so they find a reason to disqualify you, and that you therefore end up only with people who are, in a sense, too ignorant or uninvolved, or at least who we know nothing about, to be decided. So that would be a probable possibility, but it seems pretty clear if I read this that if anything they had an excess supply of jurors because they were paying, although paying at a fairly low rate. Yeah. Yes, but what they're doing is the lottery is not for who gets to be a juror, but for who is on which case.
Yeah,
that's right.
Isn't that way you can kind of eliminate the gaming system?
Yes.
You're not necessarily involved yourself.
You're unlikely. I think there are 10 courts, so maybe you've got one chance in 10 of getting on the case that somebody's bribed you or that you feel strongly about it. No, that's right. But in addition, if there are more volunteers than there are jurors, which there apparently usually are, you may not get on any case. So what that suggests is if you want to bribe people, you're going to want to either rig the lottery that assigns them to cases, and we don't know if they did that. There's a comment that the person who prosecuted Socrates apparently had at least been accused earlier, before the fancy system we were describing, of having figured out a way, but we don't know what that way was, of rigging the process so as to bribe jurors, and that they instituted this complicated system perhaps in response to that. But you can certainly see that one of the potentials is, and in particular, if you think about the fact that the jurors, suppose I'm right that those three ovals are somewhere around a drachma, and again, I'd have to go back and look at the stuff to see if I got that right, and if you have cases where the amount in controversy can be many thousands of drachma, you could certainly see that bribing a couple of hundred jurors might be a very sensible investment if you could only figure out a way of doing it. How common that was, we don't know, but clearly it was something that they worried about and should have worried about, I think. Three obol with half a drachma. I've got a note down here on that is the answer. So six obols for the drachma. It's a subdivision, not a superdivision. And there are a bunch of different courts. In the Chinese system we've been looking at, what is the law mainly designed to specify? What's the main purpose, if you think of all the stuff we were reading, what's the main thing that a single law tells you? Yeah, right. Well, the main thing it's telling you is, for this exactly specified, what's the punishment? What's the main thing that an Athenian law tells you? It might tell you the punishment, it might not. The punishment might be up to the jury. What's the thing that it tells you? Yep.
The magistrate.
Sent to the procedure. It tells you what magistrate you go to, what form of case it is, because there are different forms of cases, what the procedure is, because in some forms of cases the procedure requires you to go notify the guy and then go to the magistrate, and others you go to the magistrate and he's supposed to get the guy. There are a few cases where he's supposed to be put in jail before the trial, most of them apparently not, and so forth. So right. So basically what the law is doing is saying such and such is illegal and here is the procedure for acting against it. And it may or may not tell you what the fine is if you're convicted. So that I thought was also sort of intriguing as a different approach to the same sort of thing. So why did they have such huge juries? Well, you're guessing, because I don't know the answer, of course. But what might be reasons? Yeah?
The huge juries?
Yeah.
I think because it's literally a replacement for the judgment of all of society. If you're starting with the sum of all, and then you whittle it down, I thought it was very interesting that today, here, we've got to whittle it down pretty much to 12.
Yes.
And that seems to be on the smaller set that he goes to, so it's natural that on its way from all to 12,
so that's one answer. Other answers?
The author suggested was that it was a monster that if the jury really did.
But that, in a sense, is her point.
Yeah.
Are there other? Can you think of some other unrelated theories for what's going on? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that in larger groups, this is strategic interaction of the jurors. One person can't, it's
much more costly to do 250 people instead of 26 people.
So it might be a better method. Other? Yes.
Maybe if there wasn't a therapist that could back with their own agenda, that having some insurance to outweigh him, and they can be a little
bit
easier.
Might be. Yep. Yeah, it's also a welfare system, right? That's at least a possible way of reading it, that you say, well, look, we're not paying you very much. It's just barely enough to feed you. But this does mean that if you've got nothing else to do, we've got a way of making sure you don't starve to death. So that would be another possible interpretation. Yep. Might be. I don't know. I'm not sure if it's true. That is, you know, you've got the other way, sort of the idea of the badness of crowds. But that's certainly possible. Yeah. Yes.
Since they impose a penalty if you give like 1/5 of the jurors, if you had like 10 people, that only 2. So if you make it larger, it kind of looks better.
Yeah. That might be. Why do you set up a welfare system? Suppose you're one of the people who's pushing. You've got some prominent politician who raises the pay from 2 obols to 3 obols. Yeah.
Want to have a critical mass that
doesn't like you. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that since the assembly is everybody, including the jurors, that you would like to buy support, that you want, that whoever is pushing for raising the payment or doing other things wants people to like him. Well, you know, if there are 6,000, 8,000, 10,000 people who make their living being jurors, and they're people with lots of leisure too, because they can be jurors. They're not off on the farm working. Maybe those are people who you want to vote when to condemn your enemies or to pass the laws you approve of or other things. I don't know, but I think it's at least worth trying to speculate on what was going on. Because it is a system where you can see that if I can sort of assemble a coalition of people who will show up at the assembly who like me, I can do a whole lot of terrible things to my enemies and maybe some good things to my friends. Because, yeah.
Oh, it's kind of a tax of welfare, but it's that most of the jurors are older people anyway, so maybe people who are younger expected to eventually do that to kind of bring that income.
So again, it's a sort of a social security system, you might think of in that sense. That's certainly one very real possibility. So the history of the laws is the first law code we know about is by a guy called Draco, and we get from that the term draconian laws, by which we mean particularly harsh laws, and Solon replaces Draco's laws, except apparently his law on homicide, which we think, though we're not sure, may have been survived. And in theory, Solon's laws constrained the magistrates in what they could do and constrained the juries, although pretty clearly there's no real mechanism for constraining the juries, that you can't sue a juror for convicting an innocent person in either their system or in our system. Suppose you could. That's an interesting question. Not just juries. One of the things which people, which occasionally appeals to some people, is to say, look, here you've got this terrible case where somebody, an innocent man, was convicted of a crime, spent 20 years in prison, and then they proved he's completely innocent. Shouldn't a prosecutor go to jail? Or shouldn't the police be responsible? And presumably everybody would say, well, it was just a mistake. No. But suppose it turns out that the prosecutor hid evidence that in one way or another, suppose you conclude, as in some cases I think one does conclude, that the people who were responsible for this were people who acted very badly. And it's very tempting to say, well, putting a guy in jail for 20 years is an awful bad crime. You know, short of murder, it's hard to think of anything worse. Therefore, those people should get life sentences. What would be the problem with that? Suppose we had a legal system. I mean, they're doing it in the specific case of abusive prosecution. Maybe they're doing it in other cases as well, because after all, the magistrate does get investigated at the end of his term. So suppose we say that people who within the legal system, police and prosecutors, who are found to have convicted innocent people, will then themselves be tried, and if it turned out that they were negligent or in other ways acted badly, that will be considered a criminal offense. What might be a reason not to do that? Yeah? That would be one problem is that it might make it harder to hire prosecutors, depending on how likely this event was. What's the other problem?
Well, on that, it would be harder to hire good prosecutors. You might get people that then have other jobs, but you wouldn't get really talented.
Is there another problem? Yeah?
Who would you get to prosecute?
You have other prosecutors to prosecute them. Yeah, I'm worried the other way. What I'm worried about is you never discover innocent people. If I've made the mistake and convicted an innocent person, I've got an enormous incentive to make sure that mistake is never discovered. All right, so there are a lot of cases, this is where I'm probably thinking like an economist, where you give people an incentive and you've got to recognize that the incentive is in more than one direction. Right? You're giving them an incentive not to convict innocent people, but you're also giving them an incentive, if they have convicted innocent people, not to have the fact discovered and therefore to keep the guy in jail for the rest of his life. You know? Clearly, you've got the same thing happening, which just makes it happen more. That is, it's the case, I think, that there are at least a lot of cases, I think, where prosecutors who have convicted innocent people go to a good deal of trouble. You have to go through legal procedures to get them to allow the DNA to be tested, cases of that sort. If you read this book, Actual Innocence, which is a book about a bunch of innocent people who, in various ways, got eventually proved to be innocent, and one of the things that strikes you is how often the prosecution was not willing to cooperate. You would sort of say, well, look, they only want to convict guilty people. They should be delighted to have somebody, you know, help them find out whether they convicted anybody innocent. And that doesn't, I'm sure there are some who are, but my impression is very often they aren't. But this would make it worse. But again, it's a sort of, again, we're looking at a lot of legal systems. You really have to think, I think, about all these sorts of problems as in every solution brings its own problems, so to speak, which is almost the case. So once the democracy is established, then the new laws are all by the vote of the ecclesia, the assembly of all citizens. I'm not sure we know how many actually showed up, and that would be an interesting question. You might be able to look at the size of the building, for example, whether in theory it's all citizens, but not everybody lives in Athens, right? Athens is a city-state, not just a city. It's mainly farming, and you know, how much can you grow within 5 miles of the Acropolis? Probably not very much, so it's hard to believe that a large fraction of the population really showed up at the assembly, and you might have ended up, among other things, I'd be sort of worried in that system that the farmers would get a raw deal because the urban residents would vote much more often than the farmers did, and thus would tend to bias the system in their favor. I don't know if that's really the case or not. In any case, in 404, they reinscribed the law. Almost immediately after that, they lost the Peloponnesian War, and briefly were under an oligarchy imposed on them by the Spartans. And then when they reestablished the law, there was a new revision in which they said anything not in our new revision is out. No decree can overrule a law, and it's going to be harder to pass laws than to make decrees. And nobody can be prosecuted for offenses before 4032. Notice that these slash dates are due to the fact that their dating is summer to summer, and therefore each of their years is 2 half-years of ours, roughly.
So are
the terms
after the slash
date? What? No, it is a year which included our year 403 and our year 402. If you look at all those slashes, they're two adjacent numbers. And they're saying that their record says this happens in year X. Year X could have been the end of 403 BC or the beginning of 402 BC. All right, because they're not starting the year at the same time we are. Along similar lines, by the way, different societies have different rules on when the day starts and ends. All right, Christmas Eve is the evening of Christmas Day. Halloween is the evening of All Hallows' Day. But that's because both of them are going back to a time when the day ran from sunset to sunset. And therefore it was the evening before, not the evening after, that was associated with the day. And that, what appears to have changed that, was the development of city clocks in the Renaissance. That basically, until you've got clocks readily available, it's real hard to know when it's midnight, which is our system, but it's pretty easy to see when the sun is set. And therefore, you kind of think of that as a division. For any of you who are familiar with Jewish law, the Sabbath starts basically at sunset, although you're supposed to stop working a little bit before just to play safe. But again, that's coming out of a system where you think of the day as ending at sunset. Which sort of makes a lot of symbolic sense. You know, the sun's just gone out. Aha, the day is over. There is, in fact, a case. I'm not sure if it's in the stuff you've read yet or not. of a way of evading the amnesty. That amnesties are another interesting issue, actually. Exactly the same kind of problem I was describing, but set is in two different directions. Let's consider a real world case, which was that Pinochet was a Chilean general who took power. It is said, very likely correctly, that while in power as a dictator, he killed various people. He or his people killed various people they had no right to kill. Eventually, Pinochet made a deal with various other people, and his deal was that he would resign as dictator, reestablish a democratic government, provided that he and all of his people have immunity for everything done during the time they were in power, and that deal was agreed to by the successor government. And then a good many years later, I think a Spanish judge claimed that Pinochet had, among other things, killed some Spanish citizens and tried to get him extradited, and there was some case in Britain, I don't remember what, and it raises the whole question of immunity settlements. What's the good thing? First, what's the bad thing about an immunity settlement? If we say the way the world runs is that if a dictator makes a deal like this, the deal is binding. All right, I originally thought of this in terms of the question of contracts signed under duress. Because we've got this feeling that contracts signed under duress aren't binding. And you then say, well, do you think that peace treaties shouldn't be binding? I mean, it's hard to think of more duress than dropping bombs on people. And this is really, in a sense, a contract signed under duress, in the sense that the obvious implication is if you don't give us immunity, I'm not going to step down as dictator. Right? So the question is, should an immunity agreement be binding? What's the argument against making it binding?
Binding, it won't work again.
What?
Yeah, if you offer the same, if it's not binding, and you offer the same deal, no one will overtake it.
That's the other side. The other side, you're answering the opposite of the question I wanted, but that's fine. We want both answers. The reason, the argument in favor of making it binding is that if it's clearly understood that once the agreement is made, it can be broken, then the next dictator won't step down. Right? And that seems undesirable. Yep. Well, but they're forgiving his act in exchange. That is, the alternative is not... No, except that the alternative is not that we become government and we arrest him. It's that he stays dictator of Chile until he dies. What Franco did.
In Spain. There's an opportunity to negotiate with him about his stepping down. It seems like he probably has some sort of faction supporting him as a threefold
move. Or alternatively, it might be that he believes in democracy. You know, it could... Just as the Greek tyrant, they're necessarily evil people. He may be a guy who said, this is a terrible situation. The present government is in the process of moving to establish a communist state and suppress all its enemies. Oh, but I've got the army. I'm going to take over. I'm going to run things for a while. And once everything is sort of settled and safe, we can make it. I don't think we know whether Pinochet was somebody who thought the democracy was better if you could do it, but that it wasn't workable for a while, or whether he was, somebody who settled only to get immunity because he was tired of running Chile and didn't want to do the rest of it from jail. Yep.
He kind of suggests also that you can be as tyrannical or as bad a dictator as you want to be. Twilight of your career, you can always settle for immunity.
That's right. That is to say, it's one of the interesting cases where the incentives cut both ways. That if the rule is that such agreements are enforceable, however you make that rule, but if that's the understanding, The good thing about that is that when dictators would like to get out, they've got a way of getting out, which means they don't stay being dictators till they die. But the bad thing is that the dictator, while he's dictator, has less constraint on his action because he says, all right, so we murder another 400 people, so what? That'll all go into the immunity deal at the end. Yeah.
Still be constrained by the possibility of coups while they're in power.
They're constrained in both, but of course the possibility of coups may be a reason to be worse. Because through those 400 people you killed were the guys who were going to do the coup against you, or the guys you guessed were going to go do, or some of them were the guys you guessed. Presumably that's one of the dangers of sort of no hold bars politics, is that you defend yourself by getting rid of the people who you see as your potential opponents. Right?
Yeah, the degree of brutality necessary to either encourage a revolution or to completely suppress one. It's a fine line. It's hard to judge that scale.
Yeah, no, it is. The And of course, by historical standards, Pinochet killed hardly anybody. If you're comparing him to a Stalin or Hitler, it's experimental error. If you're comparing him to what we think is reasonable behavior, on the other hand, it's pretty bad. In their system, there's the distinction between private cases and public cases, where the private case is the one sort of like our civil case in the sense that only the victim or the victim's representatives can prosecute it. The public case, anybody can prosecute. Murder doesn't fit into either of those categories. It's for some reason, a historical reason, a special case. There are minor offenses which the magistrates themselves prosecute, and sufficiently minor things where they can just impose a fine, but a fine of, I think the maximum was 50 drachma, so not trivial, but something well under a month's wage for an ordinary worker. Or maybe several months' pay as a juror. Lots of different cases, lots of different categories of cases, each defined by which magistrate you've got to take it to and what the procedure is that he does. And in order to do a prosecution, there's got to be some law, at least we think there's got to be some law. There's a little bit of debate, but it doesn't look as though they had an equivalent of the Chinese doing what ought not to be done or violating a decree the emperor hasn't gotten around to making yet. So it looks as though you've got to be able to cite some law, but some of the laws may be vague enough so that they cover a lot of stuff. And then there's one other category of cases, and that's the one which is a dispute, not prosecutor and defendant, but two people who disagree about which of them is entitled to inherit a piece of property, for example, or some other claim of that sort. And why do you prosecute? Any of these systems need an incentive to prosecute? What's the incentive to prosecute in this system? Yep. For many, but not all categories of cases, you get a share of the take, and how big a share it is depends on the category of case. So if the claim is that the defendant has property that properly belongs to the state, and I'm not sure if that's tax evasion or what else, or maybe he hasn't paid a fine, then the prosecutor gets 3/4 of the value of the property if he wins the case. And there are other ones for which he gets half, and I think there may be some for which he gets less than half. I don't remember exactly. And I think there are some where he doesn't get anything, so it's not true of all of them. But often you have a reward based on the fine for that. What are other reasons to prosecute a case?
It says it's like to do harm to one's enemies was considered to be proper aims. So I guess
yes.
Like someone to find something that is wrong just to spite them.
Yes, that is my favorite one, which he mentions, is that Demosthenes was awarded a crown as his award for having served Athens well, at which somebody sued to nullify the award on the grounds that Demosthenes had served Athens badly. I should say Demosthenes is a minor villain in, I think it's the first of the Renald Alexander books, that she obviously doesn't like him, but then she likes Alexander, she even likes Philip. So that you sort of, obviously, one of the things that's going to happen if you're a serious historical writer is you're going to become a partisan of certain sides against other sides within 2,000, 2,500-year-old disputes. And in her case, she clearly thinks that Demosthenes was a demagogue. She's got a battle, which I'm sure is a historical battle, in which Demosthenes, having urged the Athenians to fight on various high noble grounds, then runs like a rabbit when the battle actually happens. And at some point when he's running, he encounters somebody who says, "Well, don't run, Demosthenes says!" And he keeps running it. But I think they're making the mistake of fighting against Philip and Alexander, which wasn't the right thing to do that time, that back in that century, because they were both very good generals. Her picture of Philip of Macedon is really quite interesting, because she thinks of Philip as sort of a would-be Athenian. That it wasn't that he wanted to conquer Athens. He wanted to be recognized by the Athenians as the leader of Greece, as the person who would stand up for the Greeks against the Persians and so forth. And if the Athenians, because of Demosthenes' influence, weren't willing to do it, he was willing to fight them to make them do it, essentially, successfully. Anyway, digression, I think interesting. And of course, it could also just be public spirit. It could be that the prosecutor says, "Well, something wicked has happened. Someone's got to do something about it. There's an orphan who's being mistreated, whose property's being stolen. I'm not involved in it, but somebody's got to stop this. So you presume there's going to be some of that as well. And of course, it's going to be very hard to distinguish, because the guy who institutes a case in order to get his enemy may well claim that he's doing it just out of public spirit. Yeah. You don't run for office. That's right. That is, you clearly have leaders. It's clear that even though you're not elected, that at any given time there will be prominent citizens who can get a bunch of people to vote their way in the assembly for one thing or another. So I'm sure that, that despite the nominal equality, you really have, in a different sense, aristocrats. You've got, you know, Pericles, for example, the people who at any particular time, a lot of other Athenians admire them and will follow them, and so forth. So there's going to be politics about that, sure. And if some, maybe someone is your rival, maybe he's trying to, he is supported from the same groups you're supported, and you want to blacken his name, or maybe get him exiled from Athens if you're really lucky. So that's a way of doing it. And as I was mentioning, in terms of the incentive not to prosecute, that another reason to prosecute, though, is for an out-of-court settlement, which, again, I say is illegal, but you might nonetheless do. Such settlements are illegal. In fact, dropping the prosecution under most circumstances is illegal, although there are some exceptions. On the other hand, at least the book suggests that you could, in fact, drop the prosecution by simply asking for a postponement on some excuse and then never coming back, never asking to have it restarted. Yep. No, sorry. So it does look as though that would be a possible element. And I already mentioned the fact that if you get less than a fifth of the votes, you get a 1,000 drachma fine. For most cases, you probably are never allowed to prosecute that category of case again, though that doesn't seem to have been always the case. In addition, there is also a procedure once a year for prosecuting people for being sycophants, for bringing abusive litigation, and I'm not sure, I don't think we know what the penalty was. I guess they mentioned one case where the penalty was 10,000 drachma fine, so presumably it's a fine up to the jury to set. I was putting up a few words that have special meanings here. Sycophant we've gone through. Kyrios is an interesting one. Those of you who have occasionally heard religious music sung in Greek may recognize Kyrie as a term for Lord there. And Kyrios actually has two related meanings in this context, which is one has to keep straight. One of them is the man who is in charge of somebody who has to have somebody in charge of him, which mostly means a woman, though I think it can also mean a child. So that it is essentially the case that every Athenian citizen woman has a lord, has some man who is in charge of making sure she gets fed, but also has authority over her. And who is your Kyrios initially?
Father.
Your father. And how do you get rid of your father as Kyrios? Yep. Right. But in particular, if you get married, now your husband is. And I don't know how many of you know, there's a Joan Baez song, I don't think she wrote it, but it's one that I'm sort of fond of, which is, I think it's the Wagoner's Lad, with this line about, hard is the lot of all womankind, she's always controlled, she's always confined, a slave to her father until she's a wife, a slave to her husband the rest of her life. That's Athens. Yes?
It says here that, so the Athenian woman could never really be without a Kyrios, but the Metic woman
could.
And so these Metic people keep popping up.
The Metics are resident aliens. They are non-citizens who are legal residents of Athens. What? Yes, that's right. That. But it could be for many generations. That is, being born in Athens doesn't make you a citizen. You have to be born, both your parents have to be citizens, basically. Or once in a while they would specially grant citizenship to somebody for some special reason. But yeah.
I would say that the women are definitely different from slaves in Greek society.
Yes, oh, sure.
Yeah, I think they still influence a considerable deal of power. There's a famous play, I think it's Aristophanes, I can't remember which, I'll have to look it up, but the women stop giving the men any sex whatsoever in order to get them to stop fighting.
But this is a comedy.
Yeah, but I mean, that they could joke about it.
Yes.
That at least women could exercise some sort of, you know,
yeah. Oh, I'm sure. But the slaves can too, right? I mean, I just think there's a sense in which all human societies are, in a certain sense, more egalitarian in the real world than on paper, because humans are humans. And yes, he's got the right to kill me on a whim, but in fact, you'll feel really bad about it. And besides, nobody but me can cook the dinner he really likes. And I mean, you can think of an awful lot of ways. And I think I told you my story earlier about the Islamic story about where the wife can't divorce her husband, but she can make her husband divorce her. And I think that would be another case where you've got surely inequality in reality as well, but the legal inequality is sharper than the real world inequality, because ultimately each person controls himself, right? You run. In order for you to make my hand go up, you've got to go to a lot of trouble. Like Grant Rand, I can do it with no trouble at all, right? And so in that sense, there's a certain level of sort of freedom or equality that's hardwired into the system, and then different institutions reduce it in various ways. But I think that does mean that you don't want to take too seriously all of this. And I'm sure that there were, I mean, I think you see in Athenian literature, men who are henpecked by their wives in various ways and so forth. And of course, there you get the some very influential and famous women who were heterae. They were not quite prostitutes, because they were much pickier than that. But they were women who expected to be paid for a combination of singing, arguing, philosophy, and having sex with you, some of the famous ones at least, and were paid very generously, were sort of important figures in that society. But nonetheless, one meaning of curios is that it's not only women, it's a child who also have to have somebody in charge of it. The other meaning of kurios is the head of a household, which could include a bunch of people, some of whom might be men. So that if you have a father, his sons, his wife, his sons' wives, their children, they are all members of his household, of which he is kurios. And there's one kurios in that sense for the household, even though he is not the kurios of his sons' wives. His sons are the kurios of his sons' wives. So in the one sense, it is a relationship of one person to another. In the other, it's a relationship of one person to a group of related people, where related includes related by marriage. Does not include members of the household who are not related. So the servants and slaves are not part of his household, even though they are living in the same house. But basically, the members of his family who are living in the same house count as his household. Oike, I think, is the term, and that was an important concept, and he was curious of that. Let me go back to this question of medics, since that you've really got three classes, as it were, in Athens, quite sharply defined. And those are slaves, medics, and citizens. And the slaves are slaves. They have some legal rights. I don't think you're free to kill a slave, though I think you're free to beat him. The medics have some legal rights, but they are restricted legal rights. They can't vote in the assembly. They not only can, but must fight in the military along with the citizens, but I think they fight in different parts of the military than the citizens, if I remember correctly. A medic after some early period, a medic woman cannot marry a citizen man, and I am reasonably certain that a medic man cannot marry a citizen woman. On the other hand, they have something which isn't quite the same as marriage, for which he uses the term concubine, where you have a recognized marriage-like relationship with somebody who might be a citizen, a metic, or a slave, assuming that the man in the partnership is a citizen, that in some cases the children will themselves be free, and in some they will be slaves, depending in some sense on the term of the relationship. If the concubine is herself a citizen, then I think, if I am not mistaken, the children will be citizens. If the concubine is a medic, then I think the children will be medics. If she is a concubine kept for the production of free children, however they put it, if she isn't, the children will be slaves. That's as best I can understand that system. It sort of sounds as though nobody has more than one wife and one concubine, but I'm not sure if that's right or not. So as though it's a bigamy but not general polygyny kind of system. And as I say, initially they mention one case of, I think it's Pericles, but okay, somebody very famous, where they had a special vote to make his son by a Metic concubine a citizen. But normally he wouldn't have been a citizen. And presumably some of the Medics would have been, you know, wealthy, successful, reasonably important people, but they were considered foreigners for the purposes of Athenian law. And as they say, they were slaves as well. And I assume Medics could have slaves too, though I don't know. And I think every Medic had to have a sponsor. I think a Medic had to have an Athenian citizen who in some sense was responsible for him. But I'd have to go back and check the details of that. So it is sort of a case where, in one sense, it looks like an egalitarian society if you're only looking at the citizens. Looks less egalitarian if you notice men, women, citizens, Medics, and slaves. I think, though I am not sure, that the citizens were a minority of the population, even if you forget about women. Women can be citizens, they're just citizens with different rights. But I have to look up the numbers. But I think the Medics were less numerous than the citizens, but numerous, and I think the same thing is true of the slaves. So I think the citizens were the largest group, but not a majority. But I'm not sure that's right, and I could be wrong. And there are some cases, very rare cases, where people are given citizenship, and I think the one that I knew about before I got into this... what does the term galley slave suggest to you?
What?
Galley slave. What is that? No, no. Oh, all right. Galley slave. Boat. And when do you think galley slaves are?
What
time and place do you associate the idea of people being condemned to the galleys as a punishment for crimes?
19th century piracy.
That's much closer than most people. Yeah, that is in movies. The galley slaves are Roman. The Romans didn't have any galley slaves. Galley slavery is a Renaissance invention. I think it shows up at some point around the 16th century or so. In classical antiquity they had slaves who rode galleys, but they weren't criminals who had been punished, who had been condemned to that. They were, you know, the slave could be the captain of the galley too. The slavery was a very common institution in classical antiquity. And it turns out there's one case in which the Athenians had a naval battle and they didn't have enough people to crew the ships. And so they promised a whole bunch of slaves that if they would row the ships and win, they would not only be freed but given citizenship, and by God, they did it. So, but that was quite an unusual case. And then there are occasionally other cases where some prominent person who supported Athens in one of the non-Athenian cities that they were allying with might be given citizenship and so forth. But mostly it was a straight system of, initially I think you had to have a father who was a citizen, and then later you had to have both a father and a mother who were citizens. There were some special taxes for Medics. We aren't sure if there were any other resident aliens who didn't count as Medics. If you were just a ship owner who was there for a week or something, it probably would have been a different category. I think Medics normally could not own land in Athens, and that one of the special prizes that could be given to a Medic who had been really nice, from the Athenian standpoint, was to give him permission to own land or to give him permission to serve in the military along with citizens rather than elsewhere. Slaves could be mistreated but not killed, did not own any property. The legal action for offenses against a slave had to be taken by his owner, and turning it around, the owner was legally liable for offenses committed by a slave, which makes logical sense, even though it's a sense in which it's a disadvantage to be a slave owner if your slave doesn't behave himself very well. It seems to have been the case in Athens, as it was in the South before the Civil War, that some slaves were effectively independent in the sense that you were a skilled worker, so you set up for yourself as a blacksmith or something, and you pay some fraction of your wages to your owner rather than being ordered around by your owner because he can make more money that way. And that was sometimes happened. I think there's at least one case before the Civil War of a slave who was a riverboat pilot, if I remember correctly. obviously that was not the usual pattern, but it was a pattern that exists, and it existed apparently in Athens as well. And there's some kind of a procedure in which a slave takes asylum for being mistreated, I guess, and asks to be transferred to a different owner. But I don't think we understand much of the details of what's going on or how freely you can do it. All right, I think we're running out of time at this point, so read the outline for, I think the outline is on the syllabus for next time, and you'll then have a more complete picture. Think about what things you'd like to discuss about this system, and we will continue this Thursday.